tech we trust. It's the people in charge we're not sure about.
Hello, everybody. It's episode 113 of the In Tech We Trust podcast. I'm Nigel Poulton.
I'm Lauren Malhoit.
And I am the Ricketron.
So the agenda this week, right, we've got a potential battery breakthrough, right, which I, when I first read it, thought, oh, this is like so interesting and so cool. And it turns out maybe not. We've got ransomware hitting SF Transport System. I assume that's San Francisco.
Yes. Yep. Yes, it is.
Somebody's going to tell us about that. HPE kisses goodbye to the machine. And Rick, you've got something on like the cable market, not like cable modems and stuff, but like hardware cables, like Ethernet cables and fiber cables and stuff, like a $1 billion market.
Who would have known?
Who would have known? I know. What the hell? So which one do we want to hit first? You know what? I want to hit the HPE kisses goodbye to this machine, right? So like, I don't know what it was, 3 years ago or something. I'm just going from memory here, right? I was at HPE Discover, or maybe HP Discover back in the day when there was no E. And they did this like huge on-stage announcement of the machine. And they had like a rocket that took off on stage and stuff. And it's really easy when you're at these events and they're doing something that's way over the top like that to think, honestly, this is just like never going to be a thing. And you're making this big song and dance about it, and you're going to look pretty stupid in the future because it's going to crash and burn, and you'll be like, what did you spend all that money on it, and why were you acting like that when it was clearly never a product? Well, apparently they're kissing goodbye to it. So for those of you who don't know, I guess it was like, I mean, it was a massive project, wasn't it? They had all this proprietary stuff going on in these servers that were uber specialized and uber high performance and stuff, but it just never worked.
Was it mostly just extra memory, or, I mean, advancement, whatever kind of new memory?
Well, I think
it, or was there more to it?
No, I think that was certainly a part of it. But I remember at the time, it seemed to be almost like advanced and maybe not so much proprietary, but that does, you know, that kind of comes back to memory that at the time it was like, it wasn't all this commodity stuff, and it was as if they were trying to almost book the trend of everything has to be commodity. We just take it off the shelf, yeah, and we glue it together, and you get high performance if you stick enough of it together. And it was like, no, we don't want to go down that route, and we want to design everything from the ground up. So all these funky memory systems and these funky interconnects and just funky everything. And it's like, you know, the market doesn't seem to be going that way. And now they're turning around and saying, yeah, well, it's probably not going to be a thing. But then they're turning around saying on the flip of that, but it doesn't matter that it's not a thing, right? Because we learned to shed load, and we're going to take individual technologies that were in there and sprinkle it across the HP portfolio. So is that like just marketing BS for them saying it wasn't a total disaster? Or are things like this a really good test bed for, you know, the next generation of technologies? What do you think?
Personally, I mean, I don't think it matters. I mean, of course, you're going to reuse some of the IP, I guess, you know, but like, who cares? And they're saying, you know, they were telling us even in 2017, 2018, they even said what it'll be used for in 2020. But by then, who even knows, like, what technology we'll be using, especially around memory? Like, I don't know. It seems like BS to me, but Rick, maybe you have other opinions.
Well, what I see here is a vision, right? And it's transitioning to more, like, non-volatile memory stuff for software to use. And, you know, much like the hard part with anything like this is it's really hard to get your head around the use case because there aren't apps to use it yet. There isn't an immediate problem that's solved by this hardware. So I'm all about having the right hardware for the application, right? And, you know, what this says, and you kind of, Meller scraped out a photo from the PowerPoint, and it says 2020 and onwards, which is still 3+ years away, that non-volatile memory technology used across multiple products, right? And then even before that, to use a lot of RAM, right? So it's more, it's not even a storage conversation. It's a memory and non-volatile, a RAM and non-volatile memory discussion. So I think that if you can run in this faster and then also banking on higher density, smaller footprint memory and NVMe storage through these non-volatile memory situations, you're going to get an incredible performance. They give one use case of in-memory SAP databases. You know, that might be interesting. So I think that they're kind of solving a little bit of high compute or high performance computing, but they're kind of bringing it down to the masses so that you can use these things in everyday capacity and then interleaving to other products possibly. It's a vision that isn't really drawn with hard lines to the future. So, you know, let it play is the way I look at it.
Is the NVMe a smaller footprint? I mean, the machine certainly wasn't a smaller footprint at 4U and 6 inches extra on either side of a rack, but so is the memory? I mean, is that, I just don't know.
I didn't say NVMe, did I? I meant NVMe, non-volatile memory, because it is...
Oh, you're right, sorry.
I'm reading this bit from Meller, and it's talking about true non-volatile memory used for software. So there's like things like, and the example they use, which must have been something that HP told Meller, SAP HANA in-memory databases, Hadoop software, and real-time big data analytics, right? Those are, with the exception of SAP, because it's an established player, but those other two are emerging use cases. And honestly, they're kind of tacky to put on existing infrastructure. Maybe things like this would do better for real-time big data and analytics, even of smaller data. So I think that the line has to be drawn to the use case, and it's just not very clear right now, but I kind of see where they're going.
So you think maybe it's just a bit ahead of its time?
Possibly, you know, without established use case. You don't have any, at least I don't believe there's any like software partners saying, hey, we plan on supporting this.
Uh-huh.
That'd be different. That would be different.
Okay, and I'm not having a knock at HP here, actually, because I'm actually a bit of a fan these days, but you don't put a product on stage, I don't think, in my book, right, and make this huge song and dance about it when you haven't got solid lines and a lot of solid lines drawn to a lot of solid use cases, right? I mean, they had the press there, they had everybody there. It was like, woohoo, you know, big party. And if whatever it is now, 3 years later or whatever, there still really aren't that many solid use cases. Like, who made the decision to put that out there and to say it was a thing? It just, to me, right, it smacks of a project that was led by engineering.
For technology's sake.
Right. If you get all of your top engineers in and say, hey, build something that would be your wildest dreams, right? And they build this and it's like got loads of awesome technology in it, but who's going to use it for what? And it's going to cost like 3 times the earth to buy one. I'm like,
Well, play it the other way, Nigel. I mean, the way that these types of things work, first of all, this is HP's second Discover. They had another one in the States earlier in the year, right? And then on top of that, this event isn't even over yet. I think officially today is the first day. So where I'm going with that is they might stagger throughout a calendar year. HPE may stagger throughout the calendar year a number of different things. Like this is something that our R&D is working on, forward thinking, progressive, right? And then they might have more practical things like, you know, the latest speeds and feeds and whatever on existing products and stuff, right? So if you think about the whole year, this is the news of, I guess, was it today or yesterday? I can't quite remember. And there might be more throughout the week of this event, right? Because I'm on Tuesday.
Well, it wasn't announced this week, though. They're announcing that we're kissing it goodbye. This was 2 years ago.
Well, because it's going to be incorporated into other products.
Uh-huh.
That's what they're saying. But the other kind of edge of that is, honestly, maybe they ran out of announcements.
Yeah. I mean, so it does sound like...
you got to put something on Tuesday.
Yeah. It really sounds like you're clutching at straws there to say we're going to use it in other products. It's like, we've got to say something about it, right? We can't say it's been a total disaster and a total waste of our time. Not sold on. Anyway, let's not flog a dead horse.
Yeah, I would have, I think, let it just go. I would have ghosted.
Yeah, and pretend... What? No, I don't remember the machine. No, sorry.
Never heard of it.
Yeah.
Just stop texting.
They could have probably flipped it around to be, you know, it's as if just a fancy funeral. Is that all it is? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, I tell you what, let's pivot and talk about this battery piece, because I think it follows on nicely from a conversation you were having last week where you talked, I think, was it in the hot or not section, you talked about, it wasn't bendable phones, it was foldable phones, wasn't it? Or foldable screens, yeah?
Yes, yes. We talked about the foldable screens, and then I had sent it about future batteries helping us out.
Yeah, so apparently, at first glance, it looked like the Telegraph in the UK here had an article on what seemed like just too good to be true, next generation battery story, right? So, like, I'm reading this article in the Telegraph. I'll put the link in the podcast notes for anybody that's interested, right? But as I'm reading it, I'm like, this is almost a 1st of April, an April Fool's article. And I'm scrolling down to the bottom to be like, this is a wind-up. This is like just too good to be true. So they've got these batteries. I think it was University of Florida or Southern Florida or somewhere like that have kind of built these batteries that take seconds or minutes to charge, and then they run for like a week or whatever. They're based on supercapacitors. You can recharge them like, I don't know, million times, and they don't start suffering from fatigue or anything like that. And I'm like, oh my goodness, this is like the kind of breakthrough that we need to push phones and I think wearable devices and stuff to the next level, because the batteries are tiny as well. And then I think, oh, you know, what Rick was saying last week about the foldable screens and the Rubik magic and stuff like that, and the next generation of phones, which I really bought into, by the way, Rick. Listeners, if you didn't listen to last week's podcast, listen to it. And, you know, if you've not got a lot of time, skip to the end to the hot or not, where Rick, I reckon, unveils the future of mobile phones and tablets.
Bold claim. Bold claim, but thank you, boss. I appreciate that.
Oh, is that honestly, I had me going. Anyway, so I read this article about batteries, and I'm like, maybe this is just what we need. But sadly, it turns out that the batteries are only for like really, really tiny devices, and they won't be powerful enough to charge phones and stuff like that. So it's a bit of like a non-story, but I guess the question that I wanted out of this, right, for you guys is, do you think we've hit or we're up against some kind of wall in the wearable technologies and mobile phones and stuff? Because Mark was moaning last week that he's got one of these curved screens and it's a bit naff. Well, I've got this Samsung phone that has the screen with the beveled edges and it's a bit naff. And it's like, I don't know, the new iPhones got those stupid headphone jack. It's like we've run out of cool things to do at the moment because the technology maybe, I don't know, is holding us back. And do we need something like this awesome new battery technology to say, well, you know what, all that space that used to be taken up by a huge battery can now be taken up by memory or by processors? Or I'm waffling and this and
no, the battery
suck.
Nigel, you bring up a lot of good points.
Should I quit?
You bring up a lot of good points, Nigel. Yeah. The battery is becoming the bottleneck in a lot of technology today, in particular handhelds. You know, you remember our first mobile phones, you know, they were more like a purse or a handbag. And what was all the weight? The battery. They've innovated a long way, but so have things like the screen and the processor. And what I kind of rag on are some of the bad, total crap applications that are out there that just blow through your battery.
Oh, yeah.
And I think I even had on my one of my phones, it would even tell me which applications took the most battery, yeah. Right? And, you know, screen technologies are also advancing, which is the biggest drain, right? But then what goes on with processors and the like? This breakthrough is, like you say, a little clickbait because they talk about phones, yet then they go on to say it isn't quite ready for phones. So it's kind of not ready for phones. I'm thinking there will be some big breakthrough. And I honestly think it could be back in the form of a replaceable battery. I have long thought, especially for handheld devices, tablets, phones, that there is a distinct benefit to having a non-removable battery. That is that you can seal the device a lot better. Okay, I get that. For air, you know, if you wanted to fill it with helium, whatever you wanted to do, you could do a lot of things with your phone that way. But battery fatigue also, because of that, means that you're going to buy a phone a lot sooner, right? Take these super awesome batteries, and let's suppose they grow up and get ready for phones and mobile battery packs and iPads and all that. Then I think we see a resurgence of the replaceable battery if they need to be disposed of or if they can go forever, whatever. But I think that more lithium ion is not the solution. There has to be some sort of other technology. What I really want, Nigel, sitting on my like steroidal soapbox here, is the way Ghostbusters used to catch electric fields and catch ghosts. Oh, I want something like that to like capture enough energy from my phone to last forever.
Yeah,
like just better wireless charging. I mean, why can't I just have like a wireless charger in my house, and anytime I'm in my house, the phone charges, you know, or anywhere in the airplane, in you know,
that's very possible, Lauren, because my wireless charger that I'm using right now actually even goes through my case, so I know that you can have separation in there.
But is the problem though, you're throwing your phone on to charge all the time and it fatigues the battery more quickly? So
maybe that's the technology we need to work on, not, you know, figuring out how not to fatigue when we're constantly charging, you know, not necessarily making the battery smaller and better. I mean, it could still be smaller, right, if we're charging it, but yeah, how do we fix that? Well, I mean, none of us are going to fix it anyway. But
no,
maybe you guys are. I don't know.
I get what you're saying, though, because the reason that I buy new phones these days isn't because they're too slow or I want the fanciest new phone. I bought the Samsung Galaxy S7 Edge because it had the biggest battery I could find. And I knew that within it'll last for 2 days at the moment. So I'm figuring that in 2 years' time, it's going to still last for at least a day. And I promise you, that is the reason I bought this phone. Not because of the funky screen or anything like that. I bought the phone that I could find. That was a decent phone, right? But I had the biggest freaking battery because I hate changing my phone. And I only changed my last one from the OnePlus because the battery wasn't lasting a day anymore. Only reason I changed it. And I think, Rick, were you suggesting that the phone companies are like properly shafting us here by selling the batteries?
Absolutely. Because that's one of the things that will drive you to buy a new phone is the lack of battery endurance. Whether it's from overcharging or just fatigue or whatever – the last thing the phone companies, the Samsungs, the Apples, whatever, want to do is let you use a device forever. I mean, it's just not in their best interest. They make really good hardware today, which is kind of ironic. But you can find aftermarket places that can, you know, swap those out and all. But I think there's a certain conspiracy theory to it. I mean, of course, they're going to say, well, you know, you can have a better quality device without dust and stuff getting inside. But
oh, bite me. Honestly. When I used to be able to peel the back off my phones, I appreciate you do get dust and stuff in there, but I don't think I ever had any issues with anything like that. If I could buy one of these phones now and I could peel the back off it and it didn't look... what the hell, it doesn't look quite as sexy. I've got to have this honking case on it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there's something... you're right there, mate. There's something going on.
Totally.
They're shafting us. Never mind. Lauren, do you want to tell us what this ransomware in San Francisco is all about?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, ransomware, of course, is when hackers hack something and ask for money in order to maybe turn it back on or whatever. So the railway system, SF Muni, got hacked and had, I think, 2,000 machines down Saturday morning. They were able to actually restore everything from backup. So they were able to restore by, I think, Saturday afternoon, just using backups. And the attackers, who they don't know exactly who they are yet, the attackers tried to say that they had, you know, personal information from customers and things like that. The SF Muni, along with, I forget which government entity, NSA or someone, you know, kind of called the bluff on that one, so they just didn't pay them. They're asking for 100 bitcoins, which I think is like $73,000, I guess. I didn't even know you could actually use bitcoins still, but...
Hell, you need to listen to last week's podcast then. Oh, you can use it for everything.
Yeah, I need to listen, I know. But yeah, so that's the case with that. And what I couldn't find, though, was, okay, yeah, they restored the backup, but it was due to an unpatched Oracle system, I guess. It didn't say anything about they had, you know, mediated that they had fixed the security issue. So, I don't know, I think that's kind of interesting as well.
Well, these ransomware situations, and I've learned a lot about this actually over the years, but, you know, it does always come down to backup. And then also, you know, you always want to make sure there's some sort of offline storage to avoid propagation to hit the backups. And I deal with people that get out of this problem every day. I talk to our support team and I hear them talk about it. But the important thing to note is, you know, the last line of defense there is something like a backup. And then you worry about propagation and planting where it'll come back. You know, it might run now, but it's still planted. You know, there's still some risks of that type of thing. But this is, you know, they actually got out of it pretty good, if you ask me. And just, you know, Muni, which is different than BART, I think. I think that this is the longer run trains, personally. I'm not quite sure. But it's good to see that they got out of it pretty good.
So the thing I want to know about all this, right, because it's all over the news all the time now. There was I think there were about 1 million users of Deutsche Telekom in Germany were hit this week with cyber attacks and things as well, getting hold of unpatched routers and things like that. It's going on all the time. What are we doing about it to, like, fix it? And I know we've had the conversations in the past about, like, the device manufacturers and, you know, making sure we stay up to date on our firmware and stuff like that. But what are the authorities doing? You know, do they catch these people? And are these, like, treated as proper crimes? Because I have this impression, I could be totally wrong about this, right, but I have this impression where because it's all cyber and, you know, you haven't, like, bombed a track on the train lines or something like that, that it's treated as if it's, like, kind of not that bad. Like, when we catch these people, do we put them in jail and do we make them pay? Or what's the deal? Because you very rarely hear that side of it.
Well, not to mention, I mean, is the legal system even caught up enough
exactly.
to keep
and law enforcement, can they track these people? Or are they able to just game us all the time because we're, you know, the authorities are so far behind with technology and their ability to chase them and trace them?
They're absolutely legitimate crimes. Cuff them and stuff them. Put them in the bridge.
Yeah.
This is happening, right?
Is it happening in the 1950s?
Well, I'll give you one category, right, where they do arrest people, and that's around electronic distribution of certain media, right? There's a big story here in this, you know, you hear these in the States of people getting a hold of like child porn, right? They arrest people for that stuff. That's an electronic crime, right? So that's one example. Then you can also find situations where, I don't know if any like ransomware writer has been caught and put down, et cetera. But when it comes to these crimes, I think they investigate them as seriously as they can. But my argument that I brought up last week is, you know, follow the money.
Yeah.
You know, don't follow the drugs or the malware, follow the money.
Because are these like the next generation mafia that we're talking about here? Are we seeing the birth of a new breed of like super criminal that we actually never pull them down? Like we never really pull the mafia and those kind of organizations down. There was always this kind of standoff between them and the law. Are we going to have that with like these ransomware people and these cyber criminals? Is that this new generation?
The bad guys are going to be a step ahead, I think. And if not a step ahead, they're going to be faster. I think that's a legit risk. And when you look at how to address threats like this, it almost takes a failure to know how to prevent it from happening again, which means the bad guys are already thinking about the next way to make a failure. So there's a cat and mouse situation here in this virtual, this online, this telepresence story world, whatever you want to call it. And then something like net neutrality, you know, and freedom of speech on the internet and what they can do with encryption and all that will really, in a way, protect these threats. But I think that it's being handled as good as it can. But I think that IT people need to be on their A game at all times.
Well, what's interesting is I just kind of looked it up while you were talking, Rick, and not that I wasn't listening to you, of course, but there's an article about Kaspersky working with the Dutch police. So, I mean, that's kind of an interesting way to go about it, kind of having these security firms, you know, let's contract them rather than, you know, I mean, we all know the government has a lot of trouble trying to hire people that can do all this, these, you know, kind of white hat hacking, probably mostly because they don't allow people to smoke pot to be hired by the government. Maybe they should change that policy. But, you know, that's an interesting way to go about it, I think, to contract a security firm then.
Yeah, that's the right resource for these types of events. And I can I give a plug, Nigel? Can I give a shout out to one of my boys?
Doesn't bother me, yeah.
Okay, so, you know, I spend a lot in this space. Not a lot, but I do a lot. You know, as you guys know, I work in the backup space at Veeam. But a natural adjacency to that is IT security. And the historical definition of IT security is confidentiality, integrity, and availability. I play in the availability space, right? But there's a group, and I want to give a shout out to Travis Barlow, who runs the Atlantic Security Conference in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Don't laugh, guys. This guy runs an IT, basically a user group security event, and Travis works for F-Secure. They're a security firm in Canada. But he pulls in like 500 people to a user event in Halifax, Nova Scotia.
Round of applause just for that, I think.
Yeah, round of applause for Barlow. And, you know, I entered the call for presentations again this year. But, you know, I love listening to these people, these experts, talking about threats and strategies on how to, you know, avoid them. And my contribution to this community is to how to take that availability side of the conversation. Things like ransomware, things like how your data moves through an organization, take a look at that. You know, there's resources out there, friends, and whether it be events like what the Atlantic Security Conference has going on or other industry security events as well, you know, just give some thought to these types of problems. Every IT pro should take this as one of their key responsibilities, whatever they do.
And do you think, like, if you're an IT person, like, as an individual looking for what should be the next thing I do in my career, is this, like, a good space to get into?
Well, I think if you can apply security to anything you already know, you're in really good shape. You know, it kind of becomes something that the enterprises are going to put money out for. You can make a consultancy out of it. But if you, you know, my previous analogy, follow the money, follow the data. And when you can take that approach with security, you can really, I think, carve yourself an interesting set of expertise, especially around emerging technologies, right? So, you know, I got into it, Nigel. You know, I know you fancy some OpenStack and containers and the like, containers in particular, right? You know, like a question of how stateless is stateless, right? Is there logging on there that logs like web service information? And do I care about that if I'm running a business service on that type of stuff, right? So, you know, I like that question, how stateless is stateless, and it depends on the app, right? So you can create areas of expertise in this space, or any space for that matter, with the security discipline applied to any technology. I think there's absolutely a market for that.
Yeah. You know what I think there's a market for as well? It's like in the home, right? I want something that will just manage all of my devices, all of my connected devices, and make sure that they're up to date on firmware and stuff like that. Because when you think about how many things you have in the home that are potential weak points for you, you know, that there's your PCs and your laptops and your phones, then there's your wearables. Have you got any MiFi devices? Does your car have Wi-Fi? Does your car have GPS? All that kind of stuff. I'm like, as a home user, because I kind of, my eyes roll at all of these Internet of Things, you know, Internet of Things things that we have in our homes that get hacked and what have you. Yet I'm not on top of keeping all of the few devices that I happen to have up to date with firmware and stuff. So I'm like, if somebody had, I don't know, an application I could run on my desktop or something that would just look after all of my connected devices at home. I'd love it. I'd buy it.
That's an awesome idea, Nigel. Just like a dashboard that tells you what's up to date, what is it, and then maybe, you know, work with the APIs, just click update from the dashboard, and you're all set. I think we've got our million-dollar idea.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. Just haven't got the brains to pull it off. That's the problem. But we do, don't we? We all have these loads of devices kicking about that are, you know, potential security threats and holes into our homes and holes into our lives and what have you. And it's a mess. We can't keep on top of it. So, yeah. Somebody go take that billion-dollar idea and remember us when you make your money.
Call it the Poulton.
The Intechie Trust. Yeah. So we got one more story anyway. It's yours, isn't it, Rick, about cables being interesting and money-making.
So this is in the category of going deep for news, friends. Okay. Saw something on the Register that basically says that a market research firm, Allied Market Research, projects by year 2022, just businesses, forget the home use case, but just businesses, will be spending around $1 billion U.S. dollars in copper and fiber cables. So that's a pretty big industry. Now, only reason I caught that of interest is I used to actually work in an industrial conglomerate who created like the jacks that go on the front of that, like a stamping thing, you know, and then they get injection with the cable and then they get usually the softer plastic or rubber housing around them. Right. I used to work in that industry and it was not a high margin industry, but this $1 billion mark tells me it's a high volume industry. So I thought that, that was interesting. Of course, this is going to be, you know, something sourced a lot in China, this report predicts. But when you think about, you know, the use case, cables last a long time. I've got a whole box of them, but, you know, a lot of times people still just buy new ones, but they're predicting it as a $1 billion market, which when you think about $1 billion in terms of a market, if that were one company, you know, that's like 20% of the size of something like VMware, just to put it into like consumable comparison, or you know, it's kind of a big market considering that everybody uses it. But the bad thing is there's going to be a lot of people playing in it, right? There's always going to be a cheaper option, which it has its own you know, characteristic with that. But one of the drivers are cited in this article as being power over Ethernet. And then there's also Ethernet over power as well. But the PoE side is one of the driving forces for a expansion of these cables. So I thought it was
that
interesting.
That makes sense with all the IoT stuff, right?
Exactly. And then I just thought it was interesting to put a number on a market, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, I know that I think we all probably grok the reasons why wireless is never going to take over the cable in the data center and things like that, right? But it's almost like the cable is like the tape or the mainframe, yeah? That we've always kind of thought one day we'll have a lot less of them and maybe, you know, we wouldn't have to have cables. I certainly thought that in the home, you know. I have this box. It used to be a suitcase until I got rid of so many of them. But I have this box of cables that just like, you know, old cables from like phones from 10 years ago, just in case you ever need that kind of connector again. And it's like awful and it's got Ethernet cables in. I've got used fiber channel cables. I've got some that are still in the packets. And I'm like, you know, one day, at least in the home, surely I can have like a cable free environment other than maybe power. But I guess not. It's like the cable will disappear the day that the tape disappears from the data center, right?
Yeah, that's a good analogy. And I'll be honest with you, Nigel. I prefer a good wired experience, you know. You know, I'm not a Wi-Fi engineer, but like little buggy things. Like my house is very long and narrow. So I have to put the Wi-Fi access point just in the middle, but then on the edges it's not so good. Or if I have it just on one side, then the other side is nothing, or do I have to put up two? You know, little things like that bug me. And I think that a good wired experience is where it's at. I've run cable in my own house for that reason.
Well, that's retro, that, man. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I know we even recommend people, when we have guests on the podcast, to use a wired headset if possible, because they tend to be better than the wireless ones as well. So,
well, it's just another slice of latency, honestly, because it's usually going to a wire anyways. So, you know, it just slows things down. It's never as fast. I mean, don't get me started. I hate Wi-Fi. I hate Wi-Fi as much as Mark hates his Windows 10 computer before
he
downgraded to Windows 7. Yeah.
All right, should we wind out with hot or not then?
Yeah, I think so. Are you guys you ready for this week's hot or not?
Born ready.
So, Google apparently is, if you've ever searched for like a restaurant or a store on Google, they already tell you like popular times to that place is busy, right? So now they're actually going to use real-time data to tell us whether a place is crowded or not. They're also going to tell us how long people usually tend to stay at that place. So do you guys think this is hot, maybe doesn't matter, or not for some reason?
Well, I'll start. I think that it is a little bit hot, and let me qualify. I will disclose to you, friends, I am borderline social disorder on really tight, like, can't move crowds. So if Google told me it's red, bad, I would not go, right? I appreciate the information that Google does on traffic, like roads traffic. I think it's going to be based on some of those algorithms. And they've had these predictive things for a while on popular times. So I think that this intelligence is just going to incorporate onwards. But I do have a big, big, big complaint. I use an Android phone. I don't know if any of you all do as well, but Google's giving me these rando notifications like time to leave for this appointment. It's listed as here. It takes about this much time to drive there, and you're located here. It's really getting on me. It's telling me what the weather is, but I have a weather app, and I've got a window, so I don't need that. You know, little things. It's getting a little bit too chatty, but generally, I think it's hot.
Nigel?
Oh, I think it's smoking hot, okay. But I think it's early days as well, isn't it? A lot of these things that we're talking about in Hot or Not, and generally on the podcast as well, we're at the very beginning of it, you know? So in this iteration, it might not be smoking hot, but I think this will be smoking hot going forward. Because just anything that we're so busy these days, aren't we? Like we've got all of our personal and family commitments. We've got work commitments. We want to do things that we enjoy and stuff like that. We're so like scheduled, and I despise waiting in traffic. I despise standing in lines at places. I despise, especially if I'm really hungry, having to wait a long time to eat when I sit down somewhere, you know? So anything that will help me, avoid queuing and waiting, and because the only alternative, right, is for me to become a hermit and never leave the house and have everything delivered to me. And I don't really want to do that. I want to be able to go out and, you know, walk into a place, boom, get what I need, sit down at a table, whatever. So it's early days for it. I totally get that. But anything, honestly, that will make me not have to wait around and not have to queue and stand in a line and stuff like that is the chizing in my book. So, yeah, I am loving it.
Can always count on you for some new words.
New words.
Chizing.
A chizing. Uh-huh. Yeah. It's the chizing, yeah. So, I don't know. What do you think, Lauren?
Yeah, I think totally hot. For same reasons Rick said, you know, I'm not a person who loves being in a crowded place. And of course, yeah, who wants to wait for a reservation or whatever? So yeah, I am on board with totally hot. What I don't totally understand is how they're getting this real-time data from stores and restaurants, you know, like what is collecting that information? And it's already released, right? They released it in time for, what in the US we call Black Friday, to see which stores were crowded.
Well, it's getting the data from the existing Google phones and apps. It's silent reporting. That's how they get the traffic data.
But iPhones are like, what, 50-some percent of phones?
Yeah, so it could be like, it could be the first day of the iPhone 7 going on general sale in the Apple stores. And it could say that they're all totally empty just because nobody's got a Google phone. It's got like, well, that's a bit of a flaw, isn't it? Or am I misunderstanding
I wouldn't be surprised if you have the Google, any of the Google suite of apps on there, like Gmail, which all the iPhones will.
Oh, I guess, yeah.
Uh-huh. Plus.
True.
I think it's a little dirtier than we know.
Well, yeah, that could be. Maybe we just don't want to think about that.
We don't want to know where they get that data. But it has to be effectively let's just say in a world of defaults, it's opt-in, crowdsource without people knowing. That's where they're getting this data on masses. It's the only way. Or flip it around. They might be able to track GPS signals from the satellites, you know, that type of thing. The other option is they could get carrier data from if the carriers are smart, they're selling data on where people are, like the people who run towers, cell towers, right? So it's going to be coming from one of those three things.
Yeah, probably all of the above. You're right.
Cool. All three hot then?
Yeah, unanimous.
Very good. All right, well, let's call that a day then, I think. Thank you, people. Thank you, listeners. Same time next week.